Because my routine is shaken tonight, I'm going to have to resort to my notes. I normally start off by saying my name is Ray Choate, I'm the university librarian. Okay, I've done that bit. Then I need to say, oh, by the way, if you have a mobile phone, would you please switch your mobile phone off? Done that. And then I would like tonight to be sure and mention two things. Firstly, we have an art exhibition in this room of a visiting artist from China, who is an artist in residence at our newly established Confucius Institute here at the University of Adelaide. His name is, and if the artist is here, I apologize for mispronunciation, but Mr. Wu Changming, who is our artist in residence, and these are his works of art, and I encourage you to take the opportunity before our efforts to have a look at them. Is the artist here by any chance? Good, then he doesn't know how badly. Okay, I don't have to worry about whether I mispronounced it, but it's a nice opportunity. It's really a pleasure to me to see such wonderful things in this room, and I'm pleased that they're here. Okay, I've got through the slight diversions. It now gives me pleasure to ask Heather Kerr, Dr. Heather Kerr from the discipline of English, known affectionately to those of us of a certain age as the Department of English, if she would introduce our speaker. Thank you, Heather.
I think I need to dig a hole so I can be down low enough, but thank you very much to the friends of the Balsamith Library who join us this evening, and to Ray Choate, Paul Wilkins, who can't be here, and especially to Robina Weir for organising tonight's event. Professor Jane Rogers is a visiting scholar in the discipline of English at the University of Adelaide. She's a fellow of the Royal Society for Literature since 1994. Jane has won numerous awards, prizes and fellowships, published across a range of genres and in various media, and travelled widely. Indeed, her CV is rather exhausting to rehearse in full, so I'll summarise instead. Jane Rogers has won a Somerset Maugham Award, a Samuel Beckett Award for Best First Television Drama, the Writers Guild Best Fiction Award, and a BAFTA nomination for Best Drama Serial. In addition, she has held 6 visiting fellowships or residencies, published 7 novels, 2 TV dramas, 9 works for radio, edited 2 anthologies of fiction, and The Good Fiction Guide, published by Oxford University Press. She's published 21 shorter works for print and for radio. In addition to various international editions of her writing, Jane's novel Island has been translated into German, Dutch and Hebrew, and a German translation of the novel The Voyage Home has recently been published. Jane has presented her work at readings and seminars and workshops for the British Council in many countries, including Argentina, the Czech Republic, France, Germany, India, Nigeria, Russia, and the UK. We're fortunate that Jane now includes the University of Adelaide on her list of affiliations. You'll appreciate that we're delighted to have the benefit of her extensive experience as a teacher in our creative writing program this semester. Jane is currently a professor of writing at Sheffield Hallam University in the UK, and a mentor for the Royal Literary Fund's Writers Pool. In addition to being a freelance writer, Jane is clearly indefatigable, and we're privileged to have the opportunity this evening to hear about her latest project and the writing process, from first inkling to first draft. Please welcome Professor Jane Rogers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Heather. I'm delighted to be here, and I'd like to thank you all for coming out on this drippy evening, which is more reminiscent of summer in England, probably, than winter in Adelaide. I'm very, very happy to be here in Adelaide. I've got family connections here which go back a long way. I'm very happy to say that I've got a mother and a niece in the audience, and it's great to actually feel sort of tapped into Adelaide in a working way as well as in a familial visiting way. So I'm really happy to be here. Okay, what I'm planning to do is to try and talk a little bit about the book that I've been working on, and then to read you a short passage from the beginning of it. And what I'd like to do is to start by putting my glasses on, actually. To start, yeah, by reading you a short quote from Virginia Woolf's writer's diary, because I always come to this when I'm thinking about where do writers begin their novels. Okay, this is a passage from her diary that she wrote while she was planning to the lighthouse. To the lighthouse is going to be fairly short. To have father's character done, complete in it, and mother's, and St. Ives, and childhood, and all the usual things I try to put in, life, death, etc. But the centre is father's character, sitting in a boat, reciting, "We perished, each alone," while he crushes a dying mackerel. Okay, what I love about that quote is, firstly, it's grand kind of throwaway vagueness, you know, all the usual things I try to put in, life, death, etc. You know, yes, I think we all think that when we're writing a novel, it's, you know, it's all going to be there. But also, it's absolute precision. She has one image in her mind, a specific character in a specific time and place, carrying out a specific action. Father in a boat, crushing a mackerel, reciting, "We perished." And that image is key to the book for her. And I think that that's just an interesting thing to hang on to. Writers are often asked, you know, what inspires a novel? You know, where did the ideas come from? And it's a bit of a minefield to try and answer that question, because one runs the risk of being either terminally boring or enormously pretentious, or both. So bear with me. What I'd like to try and do is just to itemize the process in a very specific way for one book, for the book that I am currently working on, which is now nearing completion. And just to kind of take you through, if you like, the intellectual journey that has been from the beginning to the point that I'm up to. This novel is still languishing without a proper title. I just call it by the name of the protagonist. So it's called Jessie Lamb. It might have a better title one day, but that's the working title. And before I go any further, I should just stress, I'm not giving you a guide on how to write a novel, okay? This is not, you know, this is not a recipe, and it's not even advised. The way that I seem to work is, you know, like, one step forward, two steps back. It's not efficient. And I know that there are lots of writers who are much more intelligent and blessed than me, who can sit down with a coherent idea in their head and write it down. I'm not capable of doing that. So I'm just giving you an example of a process, okay? And I really hope that you can find some people who have easier processes. For me, the beginning, it's a slow process of accretion, really. It's a kind of ideas and moods, and quite often places and characters will gradually start to kind of stick together. If you imagine a dung beetle rolling a great ball and things, it's kind of like that. But there comes a point in that rolling where it goes, it moves from being something that's just quite interesting to something that's going to be a novel, and there's a moment where it kind of changes, a kind of catalyst moment, I guess. And I think the catalyst is often realizing that this is something that I really, really need to understand, realizing that I actually don't understand something, that I need to explore it. Zadie Smith wrote a couple of articles recently, very good articles about novel writing. And she said, I'll quote it exactly. She said, she writes, "In order not to sleepwalk through my life." And I think that's a wonderful way of putting it, because I think that what, you know, the compulsion to write is the compulsion to get underneath and to actually really get to grips with something which one can kind of skim along the surface of in day-to-day life. And that's why writers talk about obsession. I mean, it's like there's something that you just need to make sense of for yourself. And it's something that you don't know the answer to. It's something you have to find out. Okay, Jessie Lamb is my eighth novel, but it follows a novel that I gave up on, so it felt a bit fragile for a while. And the starting point was an idea which had been with me for many, many years. It's a very simple idea. It's the idea of a triangular relationship, two parents and a child. And the parents are a couple who quarrel, who don't have an easy marriage, and who are very preoccupied by their own affairs and their own lives. And the child is a teenager who is becoming an adult. And although the parents love her, she's a pawn in their marital battles. And almost while they're looking the other way, while they're living their lives and being distracted, she grows from being a rebellious child into being a passionately idealistic young adult. And she actually decides on a course of action which horrifies her parents and forces them to see her in a different way. She turns into a person they have to reckon with, a force they have to reckon with. Okay, as soon as I say it, you'll be thinking, "Humph, I've read that before." And you have. There are no new plots. But once I started to really think hard about it, I found myself trying to unearth, what is it about this plot? Where is it that I'm getting this interest from? There were a number of reasons, but I found myself wanting to look at the way that other people had dealt with that plot. And the first version that sprang to my mind kind of cleanly was Euripides' Iphigenia in Aulis, which I read as a student and which stuck with me. And so I reread it. And I don't know how familiar you are with it, but forgive me if I tell you all something you know. I didn't remember it too well until I reread it. I'm going to summarize the plot for you, okay? The plot is Agamemnon's waiting with the assembled Greek forces to sail to attack Troy. And there's no wind. They can't move. And there's a great danger that the Greek forces will start to fall out and fight each other and that there'll be some kind of civil war while they're all sitting there waiting. He needs to get them moving. The priest tells him that in order to get a wind, he must sacrifice his daughter. And he summons his daughter, Iphigenia, and her mother to the port under the pretext of saying that he's found a husband for her and that she can get married. Once she arrives, the truth leaks out. And Iphigenia, obviously, is terrified and distraught. Her mother's furious. Her mother rakes up all her other bitternesses and grievances against Agamemnon. Everybody's pretty angry and upset. Iphigenia, working out that the honor of Greece is at stake, volunteers to be sacrificed. Both parents are still arguing and vacillating and worrying and saying no, and she takes on the heroic role. She suddenly gains stature. She towers above her parents. She's found her mission. And I'd just like to read you her speech because it's just been quite important to me in my thinking here. "The remarkable thing, mother, as I think it over, is that I'm willing to die. And die gloriously, after putting every petty thing behind me. I must not cling to life. I wasn't born from you, simply for your sake, but for the common good of Greece." So this is a template, really. The idea of a child suddenly leaping beyond her parents, growing in stature till she dwarfs what they are. This is a template that really fascinates me. And I can reach for all sorts of reasons in my own life for why it should fascinate me at this particular point. I mean, I've got children who are, have become adults and are becoming independent. And in a sense, this is a story that every parent faces with every child. I mean, your child grows up and you grow old. Your child gets tall and you get, you shrink. You may have already shrunk. they have a role in the world and your role diminishes. So in a sense, it's everybody's story. What I also realised, though, was that it is very much the plot of one of the novels that has really influenced and haunted me in recent years, which is Philip Roth's American Pastoral. He gives it a different twist. I mean, his twist is that the daughter's idealism, the daughter's activism, is seen by her parents and by society as destructive and mad and as terrorism. And he hangs on to the father's point of view on this. He doesn't really show us much of the girl's side of it, but it is the same plot. Okay, I started to obsess about it, and I started to look at ways that other people had dealt with this subject matter, and other ideas began to attach to it. In an earlier piece of writing that I'd been working on, which I actually abandoned, I'd been thinking about a scientist who questions the moral implications of his work. So now I thought of ways of maybe linking the parents' work with the daughter's activism. That's to say that maybe they were working on something which would perhaps have harmful effects in some way, and that she would be attempting to undo that. And that would actually squeeze the parents even harder if the child is actually trying to negate, you know, the effects of their work in the world. And that then easily connected onto the sort of general idea that, of course, you know, each new generation that comes up, you know, is aware of all the stupidities and idiocies and damage that the previous generation has done, so that she can have a whole sort of agenda of complaints about, you know, the rubbish politics of the world, the way that, you know, the climate has been destroyed and the world has become a difficult place for each young generation to live in, and that she holds her parents' generation responsible for that. And so then I can get a balance of, well, because she thinks her parents' generation has been selfish, to counterbalance that, she has to be unselfish. She defines herself against her perception of them, and her idealism then is about trying to wipe out the old bad ways of living. So that in a way she's offering herself up in expiation for the crimes of the previous generation. And that led me straight into another area of reading and thinking which began to make me feel quite excited. Because I was thinking on the one hand about people who, people on suicide missions, people who die for a cause, hunger strikers, kamikaze pilots, suicide bombers, people who have an ideal which is so important to them that they will offer up their life. And then on the other hand, all the religious sort of holy fools and martyrs, and indeed Jesus Christ, you know, dying that others may be saved, and all those ancient traditions that predate Christianity, you know, where there are human sacrifices to ensure the fertility of the land and the growth of the crops and adequate rainfall, so that one member of a society is sacrificed for the good of all the others. And that those ideas became quite exciting to me in thinking about what I might do with my heroine. Okay, you might ask, where's the writing? This is all ideas, and I hadn't written anything except notes. I was reading madly and thinking, and piles of notes were growing, and I was still looking for something. And then something very lucky happened. I found out about an Arts Council fellowship in Banff in Canada, which would give a writer who got it 10 weeks writing time in Banff in the Canadian Rockies in the middle of winter. So I thought, this is exactly what I need, you know, completely new place, completely free time. I've got all this stuff, you know, churning around in my brain. It's time to do it. And in a desperate attempt to make my application sound utterly convincing, I told the people who were awarding it that my new novel would be set in a future world that would be frozen and snowbound. And that I needed to go to Banff in January in order to research this. Okay, it was a complete lie. I mean, it was fiction, complete fiction. I'd never thought about the snow or particularly about my setting yet. But Fortunately for me, once I had written this application, I got a very, very clear image in my head of my girl, Jessie, in a completely white, empty landscape, just striding along, completely happy, completely certain, because she knew what she was going to do, and she had moved beyond fear into this area almost of white light, into a space where she became radiant with certainty. And that image of her completely certain and completely happy became a touchstone for the book and became very, very important to me. Now, fortunately for me, they gave me the bursary, so I did go to Banff and I did begin to write. And the snowy setting became quite important for the book, but I have to confess it's nowhere near as exotic as the Rockies. I've actually set it in England in a snowy winter. So the great benefit, really, of those 10 weeks was not being able to research a landscape at minus 30 degrees centigrade. It was having 10 weeks with nobody and nothing bothering me. 10 weeks to write, what bliss. And my head was full, and I wrote very fast, and I wrote a draft of half the novel. I mean, I really, you know, went for it. And what I was exploring at that point, really, was the shifting balance in the relationship between these two parents and their child. That's what I was trying to understand, and also how the relationship between the two parents would be affected by this. And I was also looking at exploring what Jessie was doing. Why would you do that? What makes a person able to have such incredible, extraordinary, mad courage? You know, what's it about? So I was writing three first-person voices because I wanted the story to be from everybody's side, the mother, the father, and Jessie. And I was struggling to get the right note of naivety and optimism and innocence into Jessie's voice. I didn't want her to have kind of obvious teenage language. I didn't want it to be kind of slangy or, you know, I mean, I'd read Vernon God Little, and that's a great book, but I'm not doing the same kind of thing. I wanted her to be outside a particular time and place. So I wanted a very simple, young, kind of pure voice, a voice that would be clear like a bell, really. And the book I turned to was The Diary of Anne Frank, which was wonderful, inspirational, and enormously helpful to me. It's just a marvelous, fresh, engaging voice. And, you know, I owe more probably to that book than to any other in working on this. I'd made the decision to set the book slightly in the future because I wanted to free it up from current affairs. I wanted it to be in a world that we still know, very close to our own world, but I didn't want to be constrained by real events. So I started to think about the future. I started to read about the future. I read books like just popular science, you know, Colin Mason's A Short History of the Future and books about ecology and so on. And I also started to look again at some science fiction books that I'd loved. And in particular, then John Wyndham's The Chrysalids stood out because that's just such a clever book. It's so simple and it's such a big idea and it's so well executed. Okay, so I read a lot and I was writing and I came back from Canada with half a novel in three voices, feeling rather pleased with myself. And I put it away for a while, a month or so, and then I read it. And then my heart absolutely sank. Because both the parents were exceedingly dull. And Jessie was okay. I thought Jessie was getting to be what I wanted. But two parents' voices, two-thirds of what I'd written, was boring. And, you know, I really struggled with that. And I think, looking back, that the reason probably why they were dull was that actually I had become so immersed in Jessie's point of view that I was partly seeing them as tired and old and cynical in the way that she did, and that was colouring, even when I was inside their heads, that was colouring their voices. So After much disgruntlement, I threw away 2/3 of what I'd written. And then I thought, well, the only thing to do is to try the whole book from Jesse's point of view. That's the only way this is going to work. And that was very alarming, because I had done much less than I thought I had. But it was also alarming because I do want the book to contain their points of view, in the sense that I want the reader to sympathize with them. I mean, these are two perfectly good, harmless people whose daughter has decided to sacrifice her life. It's a terrible thing. We need to sympathize with them. And I've got to then technically find a way of showing that without actually letting them speak, if you like. I mean, okay, she can record their dialogue, but I'm going to show you it all through her head. So technically, it became more of a challenge, and I think that was probably very good for me, to be forced to do something that I hadn't planned to do and that really, really stretched me. I mean, the other thing is because I've... In earlier books, I've tended to write intercut voices quite a lot. And one of the blissful things about intercut voices is that you've got instant suspense because, you know, you take so-and-so to such-and-such a point in their story, bang, you cut them off, you carry on with somebody else's story, bang, you cut them off, you carry on with someone else's, and you've got all these lovely little hooks dangling. One voice, it's a totally different ballgame. So not only was I struggling to incorporate her parents' story in the gaps of hers, if you like, but I was also struggling with restructuring it and looking at precisely how I was going to organize my material to just keep that whole series of questions in the air. And it was at that point, actually, that I found myself going back to Euripides and looking at Iphigenia again and thinking, this is amazing, actually, the number of twists and turns, you know, will she die, won't she die, will she, won't she, that he incorporates in that short drama are pretty impressive. I'd started with 3 points of view, and I've actually ended up with a book that's only one. I then, in terms of structure, in order to complete a first draft, had a structure which divided the book into 2 parts, the first part of which was told retrospectively by Jessie, and then the second part of which was told in a diary form so that she could keep you up to date with her changes. And even that structuring is now going in the bin. The writing isn't, I hope, at this stage, but the structure is going in the bin because it's beginning to seem tricksy. It's beginning to seem like this is a complication too far. And one of the things I passionately want for this book is for it to be simple in its appearance, to have that kind of elegance, and not the complexity of being told in 2 different ways. So that's the thing that's going to come out at the next draft. The other thing about it is that I feel quite strongly that it needs to be a short novel because it's one quite disingenuous voice, and at the moment it's 120,000 words, which ain't short. So it needs savage cutting. And what I've done at this stage, which is what I usually do when I've got something that feels finished-ish, is to give it to 4 trusted readers who have all given me copious feedback and criticism and comments. And so the final draft will also take all that into account. I realise I've not actually said much about actually writing it. And that's because, in a funny way, the writing takes care of itself once I've got the voice. I mean, it's the ideas and the structure that are the 2 areas that become intensely complicated. Once I've got my voice, the thing trots along quite happily. And quite often I will be tinkering with structure after I know that what I've written is sound. It's just that the way that it's structured, the way that it's paced isn't right. So that's what I'm playing with. I'm not actually unpicking too much of the writing. Okay, I'm going to read you a bit of the beginning now, and then after that I'd be very happy to answer any questions. Okay, so I've just, to alert people to the fact that it's slightly in the future, on the front page I've just put sometime in the coming year. chapter 1. Dear Rachel, I need to start at the beginning, but it's hard to know where that is. I think things had been changing for months before I even noticed. It's like the snow we've had this winter. It falls so slowly and so gradually, flake after flake after flake. You don't think there's that much difference at first. It's just the world you know, houses and trees and cars coated in white. But it keeps on falling. And one day you wake up and everything's transformed. Nothing is familiar anymore. There are just these mounds of clean white snow and you can't remember what's underneath them. You'd never be able to pick the moment when it changed, from a scene you'd recognise to one you didn't. All you know is that at the end it is completely and utterly different. I was still a child when it started, really. I used to think stuff on the news and in the papers was for grown-ups. Even with Mum and Dad staying later and later at work and the endless talk on the telly, it didn't seem to touch my life. It did, of course. Now I look back. It affected everyone. I could never have said, it's making me behave in such and such a way. But I can see now that probably everything we all did was in reaction to that, even before we'd properly taken it in. And that's what I want to write down, how it affected me, so you'll understand why I want to do this now. The first time I remember thinking about it, well, not actually thinking, but definitely having the feeling of it in my head, was very early last spring, about a year ago. A bunch of us walked up from Mosley along the canal after school. It was a strangely warm, windy afternoon, already getting dark. The weather was mild all that February, and the short days made you feel cooped up. We said we'd walk to Katie's, but it was just an excuse to be outside, really. We turned off the canal at Roach's Lock Pub and crossed the road and went up a footpath. The path went on into open fields, but we turned left through the dark trees and climbed up the hillside to the railway line. The wind was stronger up there, rattling the bare branches. There's a level crossing for the footpath, no road or house or anything nearby, just the railway line cutting across the fields, with steep banks of burnt heather on either side. We sat on the crossing fence and shared some cans Dave's brother had bought. A train roared past, going to Huddersfield, and the hot draught of it almost blew us off the fence. It was quite dark by now, and we could see the bright windows of the pub down below us, and lights of cars driving along, and the black mass of the moors rising up on the other side of the valley. It felt late, although it wasn't. It felt as if everyone else was hiding away indoors. Dave said we should try walking along one of the rails, like balancing on a tightrope, and see who could get the furthest. "Just jump off if a train comes," he said. "There's only one an hour." He climbed down from the fence and began to walk along the rail, arms outstretched, teetering and swaying and losing his balance after three steps. We tried it, one after another, counting each person's steps loudly in a chant. One and two and three and out! And seeing who could be the first to make it up to 10. When it was my go, I stretched out my arms and I could feel the wind whipping past my ears and my heart pounding in my chest and the others shouting and laughing as they counted, and I thought, if a train comes, I'll never even hear it, and that made me laugh. I felt as if I could do anything, anything at all, and nothing would have the power to hurt me. I took 20 steps and they all cheered. I jumped down from the track and came back to them. And as I climbed onto the fence, a train came hurtling out of the darkness behind me. And gave a deafening blast on its whistle. We went back down the hill a bit and spread our coats on the grass and flopped down on them, looking up at the stars millions of miles above our heads. And I thought then, I could fix it, make everything in the world okay again. But because no one asked me to, I simply wouldn't bother. Baz was the first person I talked to about it. He's my oldest friend, not boyfriend. We were at junior school together as well. We've always gone in and out of being friends, but we didn't really talk to each other at school even then. I think we were shy of other people knowing we were friends. I felt comfortable with him when he was on his own. He's a good listener, and he wasn't always trying to impress me. He's tall with black hair and blue eyes, very good at music. Plays the piano. If all this hadn't happened, I guess he might have been a famous pianist. Maybe he will be a famous pianist. I suppose he still has plenty of time. Maybe you'll even go to a concert where he's playing. Anyway, it was a Saturday and I was in a terrible mood. It was mainly about Mum and Dad, who'd had one of their rows. The house was poisonously quiet. But it wasn't just them, of course. It wasn't any one single thing. My best friend Sal was away. She and her mum had rushed off to see her aunt, who was pregnant and starting to get ill. The TV and radio were wailing on about who might be responsible, and terrorists this and terrorists that. I think even I was realising it wasn't like SARS or bird flu or those other epidemics that everyone panicked about for a bit and then forgot. Probably most annoying of all, I'd lost my glasses. I couldn't find them when I wanted to read on Friday evening, and I couldn't find them even more on Saturday morning when I needed to do my biology homework. They weren't in my school bag, and I turned my room upside down. I'd reached the point of thinking I must have left them in the computer room at school, which was really rubbish because it meant I couldn't do my homework that weekend. Or I could try, but it would take about twice as long, and I'd have a foul headache by the end of it. I didn't want to tell Mum or Dad since they were both being so childish. And anyway, they couldn't help. School would be locked till Monday. I wanted to go somewhere where I could smoke and be angry without anyone getting at me. And I texted Baz. It was pouring with rain, so we agreed to meet at the baths. The swimming baths were closed because they had to take the asbestos out of the roof, but you could sit under the porch area by the main doors and nobody bothered you. That Saturday, Ashton was strangely quiet and empty. I didn't know how people could go on and on sitting at home staring at the same bad news, and it made me feel even more exasperated. Baz was already waiting for me. I gave him one of my cigarettes and we lit up. He pulled a face at me the way he does. The face means, everything's pretty rubbish, isn't it? Don't you think we kind of deserve it? I was really thinking about Mum and Dad, but it seemed like they were typical of everything else. Deserve it. Deserve something bad, that something really bad was bound to happen soon. He puffed for a bit in silence, looking at his tapping feet. He's always moving, jiggling his knees, tapping his feet, nodding his head, as if there's music going on inside him. Because we've messed things up? Yes. I knew he would understand. Because everything's such a mess. Wars, starvation, global warming. He nodded. But whoever's done this has probably got their own particular reason. Who do you think has? Someone who hates his mother? It was so outrageous. We stared at each other in shock for a moment, and then I know it's sick, but we laughed. We both laughed until we practically fell off our seats. Then we stamped on our cigarette ends and lit new ones. It's not us, is it? It's our parents, I said, and their parents. They've made so much bad stuff happen, something nasty was bound to bounce back at us. Retribution. Good word. The sins of the fathers visited upon the sons. Baz's dad's a vicar, he can't help it. Right, and now everyone's angry, because instead of being mad at scientists for working out how to make hideous weapons and new diseases, or themselves for polluting the entire world, they can put all the blame on some unknown monster. Baz pushed the fag ends around with his toe. People always think there's time enough left to change, he said. Well, they're stupid. All the adults are to blame. This is their fault. But they've had their lives. They've had their children. Why should they care? We sat in silence for a bit, a friendly silence. Then we talked about orchestra. Eventually we said goodbye and I went home. I'm trying to set it down logically, but like I said, there isn't an obvious order. It's history now, the start of all this, but they have different ways of telling history. So different that good can even seem bad and bad good. I don't like that, the way things can be turned inside out and mean the opposite of what I thought. I want you to have my version. I want to be really honest with you, because there's no one else I can be that with. Not Mum and Dad, not my friends, not even Sal or Baz. So the first thing I should admit is that I'm writing this for myself as well. I'm writing it for you and for myself, so that I can see if it makes sense, if the thing I'm planning to do stands the test of being explained and is for reasons I can hold on to and trust. Soon after that conversation with Baz, Mrs. Forrester was suddenly absent. Her baby was due in the summer. She took us for English. She never had a day off. I'd had her in year 7 and year 9. She was my favourite teacher. After we'd had a supply for 2 lessons, Mr. Clark came in and told us Mrs. Forrester wasn't coming back. She would never have let us down. We were doing GCSE coursework. If she wasn't coming back, then the rumours must be true. And almost at the same time, Kathleen McDonough from 5H was crying her eyes out in history, and they took her to the office and she never came back either. Her best friend, Sarah Sanderson, told us she was pregnant. She'd been keeping it a secret because her mum and dad would have killed her if they found out, and her boyfriend was supposedly going to help her get rid of it. But now it was too late, and she would die. That made me feel sick, and I asked if I could go home. People were getting upset all the time in those days. The corridors were full of people, crying and hugging each other, like in one of those American high school movies. But I think up till that day, it hadn't quite seemed real to me. No one I knew had got it up till then. It was happening to distant people. It was news somewhere else. Even when they showed the queues on TV, women queuing for abortions, it was still nothing to do with us. Until I saw pictures of a queue at the clinic where my dad works. They were on the steps where he's taken me in and out 100 times, women crying and arguing, and the police with their transparent shields forcing them back. When I saw that, I felt as if I couldn't breathe. Some women were shouting, others sobbing, some covering their faces and quietly rocking with despair. Those poor, poor women, begging for help, some with their entire families pressing round them. All the beds were full. No one else could be let into the building. I hardly ever cry, but I did then, like a kid, until my throat was sore with it. Well, I'm not going into everything that happened then because it's common knowledge. What I'm trying to sort out is how I felt and why it's led me to wanting to do this now. I want to prove to you that I understand what I'm doing, so no one can pretend I was forced or brainwashed. So you know I'm responsible and that I've freely chosen. So you know how excited and happy I feel. Right, that's the end of chapter 1. I'll stop there. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone would like to ask any.
Well, when you decided to rewrite from 3 points of view to 1, it seems to me a fairly major decision. But you would have also had to rewrite the voice you kept because it had to interpret the things. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, it was quite interesting. I didn't have to totally rewrite the voice I kept.
You had to rethink it.
I had to rethink it. But one of the things that was quite interesting, once I'd stopped just feeling like, you know, jumping out of the nearest window. One of the things that was quite interesting was that I actually was all, you know, I was to some extent using Jessie's voice to do some of that. And again, I think that was one reason why the parents' voices lacked drama, because in a way I was so interested in her story that I was giving her things that, you know, maybe if I'd given them to the others, they would have been more interesting. Do you know what I mean? It was almost like that was really where I wanted to go with it. But I just had, you know, I started with this notion of a triangle, and in a triangle, everybody has to have an equal role. So I was sort of fighting myself, but there were sections of her voice that I didn't have to change at all, actually. So it wasn't as horrendous as it could have been. And I mean, the other thing is, I think, you know, once you actually realise where you're going, that there's a tremendous relief in that. So although I knew I had a lot of work to do, at least I thought, okay, you know, been there, done that, made that mistake, now I'm on the right track. And it did feel as if I was on the right track. So it was possible to, you know, to kind of get up ahead of steam again.
This might sound a bit trite, but you've told us about the intellectual research you've done. Did you also go and do something, like walk along the railway line and see how many steps you took before you actually fell off? Because I've done that in my past, but I can't remember how well or not I did it.
Well, in fact, yes, this railway crossing that I describe is very close to my home. And yes, I have done that with my son, actually. Yes, when we knew a train wasn't coming. Yes. Yes, at the back.
Can I ask about an earlier novel, The Ice is Singing?
Yeah.
And you used a lot of snow and winter landscaping.
I did.
Presumably that was before you went to Canada.
Yes, yes.
I wonder when I was reading that whether you actually drove through a lot of snow.
Yes, I did.
To
yeah, yeah. That was that book. Absolutely grew out of a snowy landscape, actually. What happened was I'd had my my son a couple of years previously, and I got a job that was quite far from home. I mean, I live near Manchester in England, and I got a job over in Barnsley, which is on the other side of the hills. You have to go over the Pennines. It's not enormously long, but it's a very exposed journey because you're going over the tops. And we had a terrible winter that year, really terrible winter. And there are only two passes over the top. And basically, when the snow comes across the moors, it drifts and they close the roads. And so a number of things that are in that book had actually happened to me, including me committing the idiocy of driving up a road past a big sign that said road closed. Because I really wanted to get home and being stuck on the tops. I mean, there were several other cars up there, but it was night, and it was quite, you know, I mean, I didn't think, oh my God, I'm going to die or anything, but it wasn't very pleasant, and eventually a snowplow did come and, you know, clear the way and dig us out, and I've used that episode in that book, and also the title episode, The Ice is Singing, which was an extraordinary, so I don't know if anyone else here has ever experienced this. It was a very, very, very cold winter, and there's a big reservoir in a valley near us, and I often go for walks there, and as the thaw came, I was walking by this reservoir, and I heard these extraordinary sounds. If you imagine the sound of ice cubes in a gin and tonic cracking and pinging, but at an immensely amplified volume. The reservoir was cracking and this pinging sounds were echoing in the valley. It was extraordinary. It was a wonderful, wonderful sound. And that's where that came from. So yeah, that book, fair and square, from a snowy landscape, but just in the north of England, nowhere more exotic.
Yeah. You said that once you hit the voice, you were set.
Yeah.
I wondered about the place of plot.
Well, you see, with this one, I kind of, I really knew I was taking a plot off the peg, if you like, in the sense that I knew that this was the plot that I was interested in, and I knew it was the plot of Iphigenia in Aulis, and I knew it was the plot of other things that I'd admired. So, I mean, you know, one doesn't necessarily have an ending for that plot, or, I mean, one can twist it in various ways, but, you know, I always knew that the emotional dynamics between those three people and the developing sense of the child outgrowing the parent were the movements in the plot that I was writing. So then, you know, the choices for me were, well, you know, where do I, you know, how do I tackle this? Where do I begin? Da, 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 da. But the shape of that interaction was already there, if you like.
I was just thinking, when you finished, you just read to us. Mm-hmm. It's a real cliffhanger. I'm dying to know what comes next.
Good, that's the right thing to say. Thank you. Yes.
Do you move from the letter into a first person sort of narrative, or does it stay in the letter?
It's not a letter, actually, and she's going to explain what she's doing later. She's actually completely copying, as I said, the model of Anne Frank. She's writing to her diary as if it was a friend. So just as Anne writes to Dear Kitty, she's writing to Dear Rachel. So that's it's in that form, yeah. And the lady, yeah.
Do you have the ending clearly in your mind, or is that going to emerge from what you're writing now?
I had the ending in my mind in that. I wanted to follow that Euripides plot and for the girl to sacrifice herself, but I didn't know what I would have to put her through or the journey she would have to make in order to get there, if you see what I mean. I mean, if I knew it, then I probably wouldn't want to write it writing it is a process of understanding how a person can get to that point is what interested me. So, yes, I had that point in mind. I didn't know, you know, how the parents would react to it or, you know, how anybody would feel or any of that, but I did have in mind that I wanted her to sacrifice herself at the end because I wanted to get to that point of understanding how a person can do that and really, you know, be in that skin. Yeah.
You're not interested in the escape clause of Iphigenia and Tauris?
You mean that she was sort of wafted up by the gods? And not really, no. No, I thought it felt like a bit of a cop-out, really.
You haven't said whether or not you actually think this person is making a good decision or is terribly misguided. Is it something you've decided on in advance, or are you finding out?
I'm finding out. But I mean, also, it seems to me that whether it's a good decision or not depends on who you are and where you stand. And that she thinks it's a good decision, and her parents are convinced that it's a terrible decision, and that other people will take up. Well, other characters in the book obviously all have points of view on it as well. I don't think it's good or bad. I'm interested to understand it. I'm not interested in judging. That's not the game. Sorry, there was somebody I think behind. Yes.
You mentioned about when you went from three voices to the voice of Jesse.
Yeah.
How you had to devise something to make the parents sympathetic.
Yeah.
Said you had to think of advice. Just explain what you did do.
Well, there are a number of things that I did. I mean, the easiest and most obvious technique is to allow them to speak, that is to say, for there to be conversations between them, which Jessie reports, although she doesn't necessarily understand them entirely, but the reader will understand because the reader comes to it with a more adult and sophisticated knowledge. So that's perhaps number one most easy and most obvious way. But then, there are some things that the parents actually do, which Jessie sees as being stupid and self-centered, and which the reader then later comes to understand she's completely misinterpreted. So it's that thing of kind of being aware of the strand of their story, you know, alongside hers and in the gaps of hers, that they have their own lives and their own reasons. In particular, a character who's quite important in the novel is the mother's sister, Jessie's aunt, who the mother is looking after. She's quite sick. And there's a lot of things that go on between the mother and the aunt that Jessie actually doesn't understand and blames her mother for. But the reader hopefully will see that that's not the case. So does that answer the question? Yes.
I'm not going to officially thank our speaker, but I personally do thank her for a very interesting talk. In a minute, I'll introduce the president of the Friends of the Barr-Smith Library, or the University of Adelaide Libraries, to officially thank our speaker. I've been inspired by listening to you, Jane, to think maybe I should go home and write the great American novella. But I fear Annie Proulx beat me to it.